From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The first round of the Women's World Cup is two-thirds over. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll separate the soccer contenders from the pretenders. We'll do the same as regards the remaining Major League Baseball playoff hopefuls. Also, a chat with a columnist blessed to have watched the truly remarkable Detroit Tigers all season long. Also ahead on Only a Game, the story of Jimmy O'Connell's banishment from baseball in 1924 as told by historians and family members.
We always felt that he got a very bum rap, and we always wanted his story to be told again so that he could be considered as the great ball player and wonderful human being that he was.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Two rounds of explosives hit a hotel in Baghdad today, where many staff of the U.S.-run interim government stay. No one was killed or injured in the attack. From Baghdad, NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The Al-Rashid Hotel is barricaded behind barbed wire and jersey barriers. It's in a complex protected by U.S. soldiers, and anyone entering it must go through multiple checkpoints. But two projectiles, apparently fired from a neighborhood north of the complex, managed to reach the hotel. One struck between the 13th and 14th floors, one landed in the courtyard. A U.S. military spokesperson says there was minor physical damage. Two other rounds hit nearby homes. After the incident, U.S. troops found a homemade multiple rocket system attached to a motorcycle battery in the area, according to military sources. It's not clear that system was used in this attack. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
West of Baghdad last night, U.S. troops shot and killed two Iraqis at a checkpoint in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. Four other Iraqis were wounded. Officials say the troops fired after a vehicle refused to stop at the checkpoint. Senate Republicans are pushing for speedy approval of the $87 billion that President Bush has requested for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The chairman of the Appropriations Committee announced yesterday that he'll draw up legislation early next week for the full Senate's consideration. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senate Democrats say more hearings are needed on the $87 billion request, but Appropriations Chair Ted Stevens says no and his panels to draft a bill for that money next Tuesday.
To me, nothing is more important than demonstrating to those people who are in uniform in Iraq that we mean business. They need this money.
North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan says he'll demand that $20 billion for Iraq's reconstruction be a loan rather than an outright grant, as the White House wants.
This is not an impoverished country. This is a country with substantial wealth under its sands. Pumping that wealth in the form of oil and selling it produces substantial revenue for this country of 24 million people.
Some GOP lawmakers also say Iraq should eventually repay U.S. taxpayers for reconstruction. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Bush is meeting again today with Russian President Vladimir Putin, a guest at the presidential retreat Camp David in Maryland. The two leaders were expected to discuss post-war Iraq, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and efforts to fight terrorism. Putin had opposed the war in Iraq. The U.S. is concerned about Russian assistance to Iran. The Russians are helping to build a power plant in southern Iran. The U.S. fears that the Russian technology could help Iran develop nuclear weapons. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A rocket took off this morning from northern Russia on a mission to launch satellites. It carried two Russian military satellites, as well as satellites from Turkey, Britain, South Korea, and Nigeria. This is Nigeria's first satellite in space. Republican Congressman Bill Janklow of South Dakota has pleaded not guilty to second-degree manslaughter stemming from a traffic accident that killed a motorcyclist. Kirk Nickish of South Dakota Public Radio reports.
Besides the felony manslaughter charge, Janklow faces counts of reckless driving and two other misdemeanors. Janklow told the judge he understood all of the charges against him and pleaded not guilty to each of them. Police say the state's only congressman ran a stop sign and was speeding when he collided with a motorcycle last month, killing its rider. Members of the victim's family, as well as some Janklo supporters, were present at the arraignment in the congressman's hometown. A trial is set for December 1st. Janklo is allowed to remain free on bond. Earlier this week, the former four-term governor said he couldn't be sorrier for what's happened. If convicted, Representative Janklo could receive up to 10 years in jail just on the manslaughter charge. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Direct Marketing Association, which represents telemarketers, is telling its members to observe the Do Not Call list, even though the National Registry does not have the force of law. More than 50 million home and cellular numbers have been placed on the list for people who don't want calls from telemarketers. It was supposed to take effect Wednesday, but a federal judge ruled the list violates free speech rights because it applies to calls from businesses but not from charities. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Today and tomorrow, play in the first round of the Women's World Cup will conclude. On a windy field at Harvard University on Thursday afternoon, the Japanese team practiced for today's Group C match against the Canadian team. Both Japan and Canada have beaten Argentina and lost to Germany, meaning that only the winner of today's game will go through to the quarterfinal round of the World Cup. Perennially strong Norway also faces the possibility of early elimination, albeit a remote possibility. The Norwegians were beaten 4-1 by an energized Brazil on Wednesday. At a press conference on Friday morning, Norway star Dagny Melgren explained what she and her teammates had done wrong in their midweek game.
Brazil had a really good game and took advantage of that, and I think we made them a better team. We gained a lot of space to kind of show off. They're very good technical players, so we gave them a lot of space.
Norway, the reigning Olympic champion, have been known to improve dramatically over the course of various tournaments. Dagny Melgren expects that to be the case beginning this afternoon, never mind the 4-1 loss to upstart Brazil.
This game is forgotten. We don't think about that anymore. I mean, it's true, like in the Olympics we had one bad game, so, I mean, it's loud, but we just have to focus on Saturday's game against South Korea and try to reach the quarterfinal.
Going into this weekend's matches, only Germany and Russia are assured of places in the tournament's quarterfinal round, although the U.S. team, winners over Sweden and Nigeria, can hardly miss going through. After beating Ghana, China, the runner-up in the 99 World Cup, had to come from behind to tie Australia on Thursday in Carson, California, leaving in doubt the prospects of the former powerhouse. Without any doubt, the most mysterious team in the tournament is the side from North Korea. They have, to their credit, a win over the Chinese in preliminary play, but very few of the other teams at the World Cup have played against North Korea. Last Saturday, for their first game against the team from Nigeria, the North Koreans drew a considerable number of Korean fans to Lincoln Financial Stadium in Philadelphia. Among them was 43-year-old Kyo Suh, a South Korean now living in Washington, D.C., who characterized his countrymen in the stands as follows.
They're very into sports, so they are following the North Korean team, of course. But for us to cheer for North and South Korea, I think it's a recent event. You know, for many years, we were taught to hate each other. So we were taught not to cheer for North Korea at all, or even mention North Korea, or talk to North Korea.
Kyo Suh maintained that it would be a very big deal indeed if the team from North Korea not only managed to beat Nigeria, but also advanced in the tournament.
We'll be thrilled. That's why we're here cheering. You know, so many of us are here that wishing that Korea will win. You know, we don't care about ideology or political differences right now. What we're thinking right now is Korean blood, and it's Korea, you know, whether you're from North or South Korea. So we cheer for both North and South Korea.
In the game Kyo Suh and his fellow South Koreans had come to see, the North Korean team blanked Nigeria 3-0. In the press conference that followed the match, Jin Pyul Hui, who scored twice for the winners, was asked how she felt about her team's performance.
All the members of the team ran as one with team spirit with one mind and one determination. Especially they ran very hard with full power and full determination rendered by the General Kim Jong-il.
North Korea will face the U.S. team tomorrow in Columbus, Ohio. Jin Pyul Hui was next asked how she felt about taking on the defending World Cup champion.
I don't have many players I know in USA team. I am determined to do my best to give the joy and the happiness to the General Kim Jong-il.
As it turns out, General Kim Jong-il will probably be restricted to the happiness he could extract from North Korea's win over Nigeria. On Thursday, Sweden beat the North Korean team 1-0. The team from South Korea fared even less well, losing to both Brazil and France. South Korea faces the aforementioned somewhat chagrined but very determined Norwegian team this afternoon in Foxborough, Massachusetts. By beating the Mets 4-3 last night, the Florida Marlins earned the National League's wild card slot for Major League Baseball's playoffs. By losing to the Brewers, the Houston Astros fell half a game behind the Cubs in the only division race still to be decided. By losing to the Twins, the Detroit Tigers surprised nobody. Detroit is currently 41-119, only one loss away from tying the New York Mets' 1962 mark of 120 losses. It's been a very tough season for Detroit fans. From a disappointing start, the Tigers settled into a long streak of hapless misery before finally putting together a futile stretch run characterized by disappointment. Drew Sharp is a sports columnist for the Detroit Free Press. He joins me now from Detroit. Drew, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for the invitation.
I was maybe a little unfair to the Tigers when I mentioned their stretch run. They actually won three games in a row on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to avoid that chance at the worst regular season record, at least in terms of winning percentage. Was the team's motivation through that stretch trying to avoid the label of worst team in the modern era?
Well, I think they were obviously concerned about getting tagged with that title, but also they're playing teams that we're pretty much their postseason fate had already been determined by that time. So the Minnesota Twins are resting all of their key guys right now because they're saving them for the playoffs for next week.
Mm-hmm. Now, the most common explanation for Detroit's miserable performance is the presence in the dugout of too many players who should still be in the minor leagues. If I've heard that once, I've heard it 12 times this year. How did management put itself in that situation?
Well, because they have been in a situation where they've been unable to develop their own talent, really, for the last 20 years. They've tried to spend money on marginal free agents, and that's been a disaster as well. So I think they finally realize that they have to go back to square one once again, and they use this season, really, as just an evaluation process, just to throw as many young guys out there and see how they could handle it. And then at the end of the season, evaluate if any of those guys have the makings of being a future decent professional ball player. And I think they've probably only come away with two or three.
Who want to get out of there, probably. These are guys calling their agents saying, please, help, get me out of here, right?
Well, no, these are guys who are just happy to be in the major leagues, even though they're not really on a major league team right now. But, it's been a trying season for a lot of people connected with this organization because I think they knew at the start of the year that this team was going to lose 100 games. I think even they were stunned that they would be flirting with immortality.
Now, have you come across any of the Detroit players who've been capable of seeing the perverse humor in this situation?
No.
It's just not there.
No, it's just not there. And, the players, Mike Hiroth, the pitcher who became the first 20-game loser since 1980, is a good guy, and you wouldn't wish something like that upon anyone. And even he could not really find humor in this. He believes that, through adversity you gain strength, and the hope is that, it will make him a tougher player, a tougher pitcher, more importantly, a tougher person as a result of this. But, it was impossible for these guys to look at this as lightheartedly as a lot of us on the outside have.
How about you and your colleagues in the press? What have you guys done to make this incredible season bearable?
Well, I've been ignoring them, basically, as a columnist. I've I've only been to three games. And it was funny. I went the opening day, and I joked to some of the writers, well, you won't see me again until they challenge the New York Mets. And I was just half-joking at the time. And I did not come back to another game until Labor Day to set the stage for what could be a record-setting month. So, I mean, I knew they were going to be bad, but, you know, just being a smart aleck at the time, you know, thought, oh, this team could possibly challenge for 120. But I think what's happened with the media in this town is that there's just a growing sense of apathy, and that it's wasted breath to even criticize this team, because I think everyone realizes that if they do recover from this and again become a team that's worthy of championship contention, you're looking at another 6 or 7 years tops before that can happen.
The usual move when a team is this bad, in fact, when a team is not nearly this bad, is to fire the manager. Is anybody blaming Alan Trammell for all this?
No one with any shred of common sense is blaming Alan Trammell for this, because how can you? You know, Alan Trammell was not his strategy just to stick a bunch of young guys in there. You know, it's management. It's ownership that decided to do that. And, you know, to criticize Alan Trammell is to say that you could bring in Joe Torre or any other manager, one of the reputable managers, and think things would be different. Connie Mack could be managing this team, and they would be lucky to win 40 or so games.
I guess maybe the one bright side to the Tigers' season is that the NFL Lions and the NHL Red Wings have got to be a step up, right, no matter how their seasons go.
The one bright side to the Tigers' season is that it's over tomorrow. That's the only bright side to this season. You know, the Lions are, you know, they've had their problems, and the Red Wings are really the only team in Detroit that, you know, people can really take seriously. But, you know, I think people are just waiting for this thing to just get over with.
Drew Sharp is a sports columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Drew, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Glad to do it.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Arena Football League Commissioner David Baker recently, quote, declined to put a price on the soul. Sound theology and good business as well, as the Philadelphia Soul became the 18th team in the ever-expanding Arena Football League, which has also recently added the New Orleans Voodoo. I wonder what will happen when the Soul confronts the Voodoo. Anyway, the owner of the Soul, so to speak, is 41-year-old rocker John Bon Jovi, who impressed Commissioner Baker by asking him recently about the emergency quarterback rule. Though he says he'll hold a private performance for Soul season ticket holders, Bon Jovi promised that he would not be the halftime entertainment at Soul games, said he planned to sit in the owner's box.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, the New York Yankees blasted Baltimore 11-2, but the Birds rebounded in Game 2 to beat New York by a score of 3-2. Minnesota handed Detroit its 119th loss of the season by a virtue of a 5-4 win. Cleveland edged Toronto 2-1, and Boston bested Tampa Bay 7-2. Elsewhere, the White Sox overthrew the Royals 11-2, and Anaheim vanquished Texas 5-3. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, 13 years ago, Margaret Laybourne, who was 65 years old at the time, wrote me a long letter explaining that she was the niece of a former ballplayer named Jimmy O'Connell, whom Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis had banned from organized baseball in 1924. In her letter, Ms. Laybourne referred to the newspaper clippings that documented her uncle's prowess and his disgrace. She said Jimmy's widow had ordered the clippings burned, but, well, truth being stranger than fiction,
my cousin gave me some of these clippings this summer. She had hoodwinked my aunt, and the paper she watched burned was actually bags of other clippings exchanged on the way out to the ash pit for the bag of O'Connell clippings. Are you interested in this story?
I was interested, but I was interested in a lot of stories. Margaret Laybourne's letter about her uncle, the ex-ball player, found its way to the bottom of the pile on my desk. And then this past spring, she wrote me again regarding the same matter, Jimmy O'Connell.
I am now 78 years old, and I still think we should tell his story because he's always been my hero, our family's hero, and we always felt that he got a very bum rap. And we always wanted his story to be told again so that he could be considered as the great ball player and wonderful human being that he was.
Jimmy O'Connell first gave promise of being a great ball player when he broke into the Pacific Coast League with the San Francisco Seals in 1919. He was a big enough star so that when he left the team for a day under temporarily mysterious circumstances, his departure made the San Francisco papers.
James J. O'Connell left Sacramento yesterday under the pretext that he was ill. But today it was learned authentically that the reason for his absence was a matter of signing a life contract. The marriage of O'Connell will not interfere with his presence in the lineup tomorrow when the Seals meet Los Angeles in one of the crucial series of the year. It was announced by Jack Miller, manager of the Seals.
According to Margaret Laybourne, my initial source for all matters relating to Jimmy O'Connell and to Margaret's sister, Mary Maffeo, the marriage followed directly from O'Connell's choice of career.
They fell instantly in love. She was a beautiful Irish girl, and he was a big, handsome Irish ball player. It was a perfect match.
She was a little bit of a flapper, too. That was the flapper age.
If Esther Doran O'Connell was, in fact, a bit of a flapper, she must have been delighted with the circumstance that did eventually interfere with Jimmy O'Connell's presence in the lineup of the San Francisco Seals. In 1922, young O'Connell's talent, which earned him comparisons to Babe Ruth, caught the attention of New York Giants manager John McGraw, and the Giants bought the San Francisco Stars contract from the Seals for $75,000. At the time, a record sum for a minor league player. Jimmy and his bride moved to New York and the big leagues. Flapper heaven. O'Connell's arrival did not go unnoticed.
Well, I have an Al Jolson story. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Esther said that they loved going to nightclubs, and they went to a nightclub one night where Al Jolson was performing, and he flashed the spotlight on them and said, "Folks, here's Jimmy O'Connell. He hit a home run today, and you ain't seen nothing yet."
Wait a minute, I tell you. You ain't heard nothing. Toot, toot, tootsie. Goodbye. Toot, toot, tootsie. Don't cry.
Al Jolson's endorsement notwithstanding, Jimmy O'Connell did not immediately eclipse Babe Ruth. John McGraw rarely gave rookies much playing time, no matter what they'd cost the ball club. O'Connell's job with the Giants was to sit and listen and learn. Unhappily, late in the autumn of his second season, he listened to the wrong guy or guys before he'd learned enough to brush them off. Allegedly at the behest of Coach Cozy Dolan, Jimmy O'Connell committed baseball's unforgivable indiscretion. His Giants needed just one more win over the last few games of the season to grab the National League pennant. They were playing the Philadelphia Phillies, a seventh-place club that year. Before the game, Jimmy O'Connell walked across the infield and began a conversation with an old San Francisco friend named Heinie Sand, now employed by the Woeful Phils. According to subsequent testimony from Sand, the conversation went something like this.
Jimmy O'Connell asked me what our club thought of his club in winning the pennant. I said to him, "Why, I hope the best club wins, Jimmy."
That is not it. How do you fellows feel towards us winning the pennant?
I don't know. I would like to see it end up in a tie.
Would $500 change your opinion, Heinie?
Jimmy, I am not interested.
All right, Heinie. This is just between you and I. It needn't go no further. You go out there and do your best.
It needn't go no further, Jimmy is alleged to have said, and perhaps it wouldn't have if he'd made his proposal in, say, 1917 or 1918. Baseball's early days were full of fixes and dumped games, but the infamous Black Sox scandal in 1919 and the monstrous publicity it generated changed everything. Concerned that fans would eventually turn away from baseball unless they felt the players could be trusted, the Major League owners hired Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis as the game's first commissioner. They gave Landis not only a lifetime appointment, but the discretion to operate without restraint. Well aware that at least one of the infamous Black Sox, Buck Weaver, had been banished from baseball not because Weaver played to lose, but simply because he did not report the scheme his teammates had embraced, Heinie Sand sang. Within a matter of hours, word of Jimmy O'Connell's $500 proposition made its way to Landis. The judge took a train to New York and checked into room 670 at the Waldorf Astoria. David Pietrucha, author of Judge and Jury, a recent biography of Landis, maintains that the subsequent meeting between the judge and the young ballplayer was both straightforward and bizarre.
Landis brings O'Connell into testify in a hotel room in New York City, and O'Connell does something just as amazingly stupid as attempting to bribe Heinie Sand, is he readily admits it to Landis. And Landis admits later on, if O'Connell had simply denied it, it would have been, he said, he said. He would not, as a judge, as a commissioner, had enough evidence to support banning this young fellow from baseball.
In a newspaper article written some years after O'Connell's banishment, Jimmy's father acknowledged, "It was the way I reared him. I wanted him to represent the highest ideal in manhood. I taught him to tell the truth at any cost. Even when I would question him about boyish pranks, he'd never tell a lie. That's how he used to escape chastisement." The tale, as Jimmy O'Connell told it to Judge Landis, had New York coach Cozy Dolan originating the scheme and several Giants veterans, Frankie Frisch, Ross Youngs, and George Kelly, encouraging O'Connell to offer $500 to Heinie Sand. Dolan, like O'Connell, was called before the commissioner. They met on September 30, 1924, at which point Cozy Dolan claimed that he remembered nothing. 4 days later, the story had broken in the papers, and no less an eminence than columnist Damon Runyon was anxious to tell the tale.
I had a long talk this morning with Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis about the baseball scandal. If you have never seen the boss of Big League Baseball, his manner is vehement, explosive, earnest. It was all three at once when I asked him this question. What was your final reaction to the thing? He leapt to his feet, pointing a long, skinny finger at me, almost accusingly. "The appalling stupidity of it," he replied. "It left me dazed." In a pantomime, the judge enacted Cozy Dolan's attitude about the inquiry. The judge, and he's a pretty good actor, looked at the floor, looked at the ceiling, rumpled his hair, rubbed his chin, all this being Dolan, you understand, then finally said, quoting Dolan, "I don't remember." The judge glared at the writer for several minutes as if to let Dolan's statement sink in. Then he continued, "But Cozy," I said to him, "today is Tuesday. This is supposed to have happened Saturday. Just last Saturday. Think." The judge resumed his pantomime portrayal of Dolan pondering the question. Then he replied again, "I don't remember." Why, it was worse than if he confessed outright.
In short order, Landis banned Cozy Dolan, who had admitted nothing, from baseball. He also banished Jimmy O'Connell, who had admitted everything. Frisch, Youngs, and Kelly, all eventually elected to baseball's Hall of Fame, denied any involvement or knowledge of the misadventure, though Frisch and Youngs suggested that the whole affair might have been a joke. Landis summoned neither John McGraw nor anyone else from Giants management. Landis biographer David Pietrucha isn't surprised.
What is Landis's mission? Landis's mission is to promote the best interests of baseball. It is not to promote justice necessarily. It is to promote the best interests of baseball. So when the thing starts to stink to high heaven, as in the Black Sox, and when the whole structure may totter and crash because of it, then you come in and you come in hard and you make sure everybody understands what the rules are. But once the basic structure is preserved, then you can loosen the reins. And that's what Landis basically does.
On the day Jimmy O'Connell offered Heine Sand $500, New York beat the Phils 5-1 to clinch the pennant. Heine Sand scored Philadelphia's run. The Giants were headed for the World Series. Landis's discipline had cost the club nothing more than a coach and a utility player, but Jimmy O'Connell was lost. According to a New York Times story that appeared on October 3, 1924, the day after he was banned from baseball, Jimmy O'Connell didn't know where else to go but the polo grounds.
The appearance of O'Connell at the polo grounds yesterday morning was a dramatic one. He was one of the first players to arrive. He did not attempt to put on a uniform for the practice, but stood around, his head bowed. O'Connell was called into McGraw's office.
Well, what have you to say, Jimmy?
I don't know what to say.
How did you ever get yourself into a thing like this?
I don't know.
Then, breaking down, he threw himself into a chair, buried his head in his hands, and sobbed.
I can't go home. I can't go home.
According to Jimmy O'Connell's niece, Margaret Laybourne, Jimmy's young wife, Esther, shared his shame.
And Esther was so private, and she was so humiliated by the episode. Well, they approached the hotel and saw all the reporters out there, and Esther didn't want to face them, so they went across the street, I believe, to Central Park and found a park bench and cuddled there all night until the reporters were gone early in the morning and they were able to go back to the hotel.
Jimmy and Esther O'Connell eventually returned to Sacramento, to the home Seals fans had bought for him when he'd signed with the Giants. Having spent a couple of years waiting in vain for a pardon from Landis, Jimmy and Esther found their way to Fort Baird, New Mexico, where Jimmy played for a team in an outlaw circuit, the Copper League. There, again, Jimmy O'Connell excelled. Among his most enthusiastic fans were the veterans in the Fort Baird Tuberculosis Hospital. O'Connell's games were piped into the wards for bedridden convalescents. According to Tucson, Arizona librarian Lynn Bevel, who spoke to some of Fort Baird's former fans for his master's thesis on the Copper League, Jimmy was widely admired.
O'Connell became a coach and a manager for the players around there and just became an idol. You could hear it in the voices and you could see it in the faces when these men would start talking about O'Connell. They really looked up to him. He was the hero.
Jimmy O'Connell was not the only banned player who found a baseball home in the Outlaw Copper League. Buck Weaver and Chick Gandel of the notorious Black Sox played there as well. According to Copper League historian Lynn Bevel, Gandel, who'd also been a bare-knuckle prize fighter in his younger days, was responsible for O'Connell's most memorable day in the league.
If you know a little of the background of Chick, he has quite a reputation, and I guess he ragged on Jimmy pretty bad. This went on for several weeks, and I guess at some point Jimmy turned on him, because Jimmy was everyone I've talked to said he was just an exceedingly nice person. I mean, well-mannered, just a delight. And he turned on Chick and said, you know, I think there's only room for one player on this team, and it's not going to be you. And he picked up a baseball bat, and according to the bat boy, Thomas Foy, who I talked with, he literally chased him out of Fort Baird and up past the main gate, and Chick did not come back.
Jimmy O'Connell remained in Fort Baird until 1936, when he returned to California and took a job with Atlantic Richfield as a shopkeeper. That was when his niece, Margaret Laybourne, had her only opportunity to see her uncle play ball.
So I saw him hit one of his famous home runs.
Were you reminded instantly of Babe Ruth?
No, I was only thinking of Jimmy O'Connell. Babe Ruth was just kind of a ghost to me, but oh, when I saw him playing ball, it was the thrill. And I was 11.
Jimmy O'Connell died at the age of 75 on November 11th, 1976. His obituary in the Bakersfield Californian was 28 lines long. It included the time and place of his funeral service, named his survivors, and offered the information that he'd been a member of the Knights of Columbus for 54 years. There was no mention of baseball. According to historian David Pietrucha, probably nobody will ever know whether LaFair Jimmy O'Connell was in fact an attempt to fix a game through bribery or the disastrous misfiring of an exceptionally cruel and stupid practical joke on a naive kid or some combination of blunders even more incomprehensible.
The question which is never asked is, where is the $500 coming from? Is it coming from the coach, Cozy Dolan, who does seem to be involved in some way? Is Giants ownership involved? Is John McGraw involved? Later on, you find out that John McGraw hires an attorney for Cozy Dolan. He should be very mad at Cozy Dolan, because if you follow the whole thing to its logical conclusions, there are no logical conclusions or logical beginnings to it, more to the point. That here was a fellow who was not very bright, evidently, and may have taken things too far. But the basic plot makes no sense. As somebody said, I think it was McGraw, pay the Phillies to lose? They do that all year for free.
Some of the questions are intriguing, but for Jimmy O'Connell's nieces, sisters Margaret Laybourne and Mary Maffeo, they have faded, and they are beside the point.
I think that all life stories are truly mysterious. And I think that this story has had lots of different versions. But the true story was that it was a lifelong love affair. And baseball was part of it. And I'm glad it's part of baseball history.
Our story about Jimmy O'Connell was produced by Karen Given. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway on a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, the game between the Cubs and the Pirates was postponed due to bad weather, but the Astros lost to the Brewers, so Chicago remains ahead of Houston in the NL Central by half a game. Elsewhere, Atlanta blanked Philly 6-0. Montreal stopped Cincinnati 5-1. Florida edged New York 4-3. San Diego shut out Colorado 5-0. Arizona edged St. Louis 7-6. And San Francisco added injury to insult when it beat Los Angeles 10-1. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, will disc golf play in Peoria? Yes, as a matter of fact, it will. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
George Plimpton died Thursday night at the age of 76. Shall we begin today by remembering the author slash athlete in one or more of his many books about sports?
I only met him once, and he was every bit the jovial, old-fashioned, off-the-Mayflower type you would think he was. The nice thing about him was he really found the joy in all of this silliness. He had a great career at the end as a sort of professional Muhammad Ali storyteller. He was one of the first, I think, journalists that I can recall that created a persona he could sell on television and radio. But the one thing I will remember about him is that he still found a lot of joy and a lot of happiness watching the games.
On Thursday, the Boston Red Sox clinched the American League wild card playoff spot, triggering a massive celebration at Fenway Park. Another premature party, as in 98 and 99.
Well, you know, with the history and all, you got to let them have the parties when they can. I think that one of the reasons people in Boston have taken to this team is they do things like spontaneously party when they clinch the wild card spot. I mean, they are a very likable bunch. And if they continue to play the way they have played, they will be, as my friend Mickey in the Rocky movies say, a very dangerous poison in the playoffs because they have enough starting pitching to scare people and they can really hit the ball.
This week, the Philadelphia 76ers decided to extend Allen Iverson's contract and pay him $76.7 million over 4 years beginning in 2005. Did they get a bargain?
I think if they certainly got a bargain compared to what they might have to pay him if he plays out the year. They've rebuilt the team. Randy Ayers has taken over for Larry Brown, whose relationship with Iverson had deteriorated the way most of Larry Brown's relationships with various superstars have. The interesting thing about this contract negotiation is it was done practically in secret and a year in advance, which shows a remarkable maturity by both sides and a surprising one given their respective track records toward each other.
Well, but you've been saying nice things about Allen Iverson vis-a-vis his participation on the international basketball
scene,
so maybe it follows from
that. I still maintain he should carry the flag in the Olympics.
This week, NBA Commissioner David Stern said Kobe Bryant should practice with and play for the Lakers this season. The commissioner's rationale may prove intriguing, especially to John Ashcroft.
Yes, he has summoned up, and maybe this is an indication that we've turned a corner here as we wind up towards the first term of the Avignon presidency. The Patriot Act is now a punchline. He said that Kobe Bryant should be allowed to play because we don't have a Patriot Act in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
That means you're innocent until proven guilty. Good for you, Commissioner Stern. But when he says that he thinks that the media distraction is going to be negligible, either he knows there's a settlement on the table that we don't know about, or his instincts for judging media are very rusty, because this is going to be one of the great circuses of all time, every place the Lakers go.
Converse, the company best known for Chuck Taylor basketball sneakers, I know you've got several pair in your closet at home, was saved from bankruptcy in July and wasted no time at all in introducing its latest product, quote, the Loaded Weapon. Is this evidence of marketing genius or just the worst taste in advertising I've ever encountered?
It's a terrible idea, and it's the first real public demonstration of the influence of the great swoosh upon Converse, which Nike bought last July for $305 million. It's a bad thing in so many different ways. I am struck almost dumb with hilarity, though, by the Jim Haney, the executive director of the National Association of Basketball Coaches, who pronounces himself troubled, and it's a bad idea. Like, most of his membership for another $2 million wouldn't paint Loaded Weapon on the jump circle in the middle of their floor.
I wish you hadn't said that, because next week we'll see it. The ripples from the Maurice Claret story continue to further disturb the football pond. Grambling's feet got wet this week, I gather.
Yeah, they kind of openly courted him in violation of, I'm sure, subparagraph D, subheading L, sentence small f, written in Latin backwards of the NCAA code. And they're a small enough school that the NCAA can probably give them a little slap without a lot of public outcry. It is, of course, trivial, but that is that which the NCAA excels in.
Despite National Football League spokesman Greg Aiello's contention that the league and Mr. Claret's representatives had a, quote, good discussion, Claret will apparently sue the league. I wonder what would have constituted a bad discussion.
It's an interesting lawsuit. There was talk in the late 1980s that Barry Sanders would try this when he was at Oklahoma State. Depending on which court it goes to, I think the NFL ought to be a little bit nervous because I do think Mr. Claret has a case.
What exactly does the NFL have to lose if undergraduates, guys who haven't been in school for 3 years, gain the right to go into the draft.
They lose the ability to have their permanent farm system. They don't want people learning on the job. I think there is a legitimate argument to be made in the case of professional football that you do need to physically mature for a couple of years, more than you would have to in the NBA or even or certainly in baseball. But in terms of somebody like Maurice Claret, this to me is a drafty emptor situation. He is prepared right now to play in the NFL. He could step into most starting lineups next week. He could certainly step in, for example, the New England Patriots with 1 day of practice and probably start.
Charlie, Chris Ricks, the quarterback for the Florida State University football team, has apparently become an embarrassment that even his fellow students will no longer tolerate. This is even though the football team won by 40 points last Saturday.
Yeah, he's having real parking problems with his vehicle. Let's leave the how he had the vehicle aside for the moment. He is using a bogus handicap sticker to park in handicap spaces near one of his classes, and his fellow students finked on him and had him towed. The interesting thing about Mr. Ricks, of course, if you go to his website, chrisricks.com, which I suggest everybody do, it is replete with Fellowship of Christian Athletes dedicating their lives to the higher power, which, of course, brings us to the essential eschatological question of Chris Ricks' life: where would Jesus park?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and offers his forthright opinions each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Hootman!
Common wisdom has it that the essence of baseball can be found in its quieter moments. According to writer W.D. Wetherill, that is also true of soccer.
I'm a soccer dad. I like to think a good one, which means I have multivarious skills developed over the course of a dozen soccer seasons. I know the location of every soccer field in a three-state radius, know every eating and watering spot where you can quickly rehydrate a tired 13-year-old. I know enough about soccer I can sling the lingo, discuss the prospects for Manchester United in the Premier League, or explain, in a few concise sentences, the rules governing offsides. I can write out a check for travel team fees, or soccer camp, or new cleats without hardly blinking. Most of all, and this is by far the most important soccer dad talent, I know at least a dozen different ways to bite my tongue. I've been biting my tongue at so many youth soccer games, I've developed a little groove where the scar tissue is shaped by the impression of my clenched teeth. A lot of dads don't have this skill. They shoot their mouths off as often and loudly as they can. I've learned from bitter experience another approach, one that works something like this. My son's travel team is based up here in the country. They're very good. I would mention they won the New Hampshire State Championship last year if, when it comes to bragging, I hadn't learned to bite my tongue. Because they're so good, all our away games mean at least a 2-hour drive. Somewhere in the course of it, my son Matthew, anxious and bored, will ask, "Are we there yet?" Do I immediately lash out at him, talk about my sacrifice and giving up my whole Sunday just for him? No. I hunch lower over the wheel and bite my tongue. Arrived at the game, a dad from the opposing team wanders over, explains that we're only winning because all their good players are off at an Olympic Development Program tournament. Do I look him in the eye, calmly tell him that's fine with us, since all our best players are over in France playing for the U.S. U-14 team? No, I bite my tongue, say nothing. Somewhere in the last minutes, when a massive defender slices my son in half with a high illegal tackle, which the referee ignores, do I immediately scream at him, throw my arms up in disgust? No, though it really hurts to do so, I turn away from the field, pop a candy in my mouth, bite down hard. We allow a late goal, and one of our parents starts screaming at his son for playing so sloppy. Do I go over, calmly try explaining that his son already feels bad enough, that he should ease off and just let the boys play? No, of course I don't. I just hurry down the sideline, putting as much distance as I can between me and his nastiness, and though my mouth is really getting sore, I bite my tongue. Only a few minutes left now. The win is in the bag. And for the first time, I manage enough serenity to focus on the larger picture. I stand there looking toward where 22 13-year-olds play on a grassy rectangle against a flaming backdrop of autumn foliage. When the breeze comes up, they're showered in leaves, so it looks like that's what they're kicking. that they are a carefree gang set loose to cavort in mounds of purest October. Do I grab the nearest soccer mom? Tell her, look, look, look. Look at all this beauty, this wonderful game, our happy, on the verge of manhood sons. No, that would be gushing, the one breach of soccer etiquette no one would forgive me. And so, sadly now, wistfully, I bite my tongue.
W.D. Wetherill is a novelist and essayist who lives with his wife and two children in New Hampshire. His latest novel is Morning, published by Anchor Books. There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us. This weekend in Peoria, Illinois, a U.S. champion will be crowned in women's golf. But you won't hear the names Sorenstam or Davies because the sport in question is disc golf. Mitch Tyke of Arizona Public Radio caught up with the little-known legends of the sport as they played in the World Championships in Flagstaff, and he has this report.
The lead foursome on the women's professional disc golf tour have a lot in common besides proficiency in the sport. For example, they all came to it in about the same way. Juliana Corver was essentially dragged onto her first disc golf course in the early 1990s by a college friend.
I didn't know anything about the sport, never heard about it, and I kind of made fun of him because it sounded silly. And he got sick of it, happened to be outside one time, and he said, okay, pick something out. I pointed at a tree about 400 feet away. He took a driver and put it within 20 feet of the tree. And that was enough. I immediately turned to him and I said, teach me how to play.
Corver got the hang of it pretty quickly. She's won 5 of the past 6 professional world championships. Elaine King, winner of 5 world titles in 7 years in the 1990s, also didn't think she'd go this far with disc golf.
For me, it wasn't addictive right from the start. I was not very good at it for a while, and it really took me a good year or two before I grew to have passion for the sport. But it's very, very easy just to love it, and you could tell that it was something that would catch on.
And it did catch on, even as she held on to her day job, a PhD chemist and director of technical development for a pharmaceutical company in Toronto. It's enough to make one wonder if an intense dislike of disc golf, at least at first, is a prerequisite for becoming really good at it. Disc golf used to be known as frisbee golf before the Wham-O Corporation got serious about copyright protection. It's played just like traditional golf, except that players fling differently weighted plastic discs at a metal basket. Like traditional golf, the women's tour lags behind the men's game in prize money. It also trails in the number of competitors and sometimes in the level of competition. Juliana Corver says that can be frustrating.
This sport is dominated by men, and at the majority of the tournaments you go to, you'll be lucky if 10% of the people playing are women. So even though when I played Am Worlds, it was a very large field, but most women, at least at that level, are more recreational. They're out there because their boyfriend or husband is playing and they want to join along, and so they don't really take it to heart yet.
So the sport's top women are not only working to win a championship, they're also working to lure more competitors to the game. Des Redding won last year's world title in only her second year as a pro. She's also developing a school curriculum around disc golf.
It spans from lower elementary, upper elementary, middle school, and high school. Each of those teach you aspects of disc golf along with cross-curriculum that deals in the science aspects, the physics, the civics, the environmental impacts. That is the wave for me that I see the future of disc golf promoting itself.
And what's good for women's disc golf is good for the game as a whole, according to many on the men's tour, including Jay Redding, Des's husband and mixed doubles partner. Jay Redding, in fact, says in some ways the women's tour compares favorably to its male counterpart.
There's really a really cool camaraderie I see with the women comparatively to the number of men. There are a lot of good friends here and there, but the women seem to really bond together, and they're the ones that are always seem to be laughing quite a bit more out on the course than the seriousness side of the males.
The mood as the group plays an early tournament round at Flagstaff's Thorpe Park is relatively light. Like traditional golf, there's etiquette to be followed as the players line up shots. But walking the fairways, the women have time to kid around and even discuss topics besides disc golf. Even so, Des Redding says she can't help but look forward to the day when the competition is a little more cutthroat.
I do want to see the sport grow. It will be good for the game. You know, sometimes we can even be devoid of conversation because we see each other so much. So just getting enough people in there will just bring fresh ideas and fresh aspects to the game itself. And that's not a bad thing whatsoever.
Five-time world champion Elaine King agrees the sport is headed that way. In the meantime, even though it's a tough living, she's savoring the camaraderie.
People are doing it right now for the love of the sport. I still feel we're very much in the innocent days of the sport, and I think it'll take maybe 10 or 20 years before it becomes a major money sport, and then we'll look fondly to the days where we were all friends.
Juliana Korver recaptured the world professional disc golf title, easily outdistancing Des Redding, who had a rough semifinal round. Redding's final round, though, was good enough to hang on to second place, and she'll be gunning for the U.S. Championship this weekend in Peoria. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Special thanks to Betty Smith at Vermont Public Radio, Viet Le at WHYY in Philadelphia, and to Only a Game's roaring 20s players, George Hicks, Bob Oakes, Doug Shugarts, Walter Dixon, and Sean Cole. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out Jimmy O'Connell's virtual scrapbook. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Margaret Laybourne, whose career advice for yours truly involves bringing the story of her uncle, Jimmy O'Connell, to the silver screen.
And Bill, remember, if you ever write a screenplay, it'll make a great movie.
You're right, Miggs, but I can't get to that one until I finish the screenplay for Outrage of the Millennium, The Demise of the WUSA, and The Triumph of the Philistines. I'm Bill Littlefield, only half kidding. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.